Welcome to Early Call Time. This is now part two of our magnificent big boy Nick Santora interview.
Yes.
I'm excited.
I had a great time interviewing Nick.
Me too.
No, yeah. He was a real salt of the earth type of guy.
And you know what? He was a fraternity brother of yours.
Oh, yeah. We did a super secret handshake right before we started interviewing.
It's pretty sweet.
Yeah, we filmed it and we put it on the website.
I'm going to be calling that favor in sooner than later.
No, we didn't do that.
But I did shake his hand in the secret fraternity.
Yeah, and
my,
I saw it.
My dad that we interviewed him, and he was like, "Whoa, how did you get that guy?" And I'm like, "You remember JJ, who you've met a bunch of times and you always ask about when I call home?" And he's like, "Yeah. You know how he works on Scorpion?" "Yeah." "Oh, okay." So
I like Chuck.
He's
like
awesome.
Chuck a lot. I don't know if we mentioned this, but in this episode we're talking about horror stories.
Mm-hmm.
I think he talks about Mr. Kimmel in this one.
I think he does.
Yeah, he has a great Jimmy Kimmel story.
Yeah.
He does. And we also address listener queries.
Yes.
Query.
One question that we were actually able to ask.
Yeah, he was adamant about not even looking at the questions we brought in because he would get fired.
Right. And we didn't want that to happen because I like to work. And I like to work for him. So,
but we got one in there.
Self-preservation type of thing.
Yeah.
Yes.
So without further ado,
listen to the intro.
Throughout all of history, they've only talked about the fame, never the hard work, never the elbow grease, never the early call time.
Well, you talk about the lows. We have a segment called Horror Stories that deals with the lows. If you have any epic horror stories you'd like to share with us.
Worse than the highest testing pilot of the year getting passed over the day after they told you to look for office space.
Yeah.
I don't want to tell. Will you guys get mad at me if I mention another podcast on your podcast?
No.
All right.
Unless it's better than us.
Impossible.
Let's not get crazy.
I'll deflate my head.
Yeah. The
hey, that goofy guy just walked in.
Yeah. Holy shit! Minnie Mouse is waiting outside with a pink bat. There's my good friend, great writer, great comedian, Mick Betancourt, great actor. I'll do a quick tangent.
I've heard he's a huge asshole, though.
Yeah, giant asshole.
He's a great artist, though. I've seen some art of his.
That's right. He's the one who drew that cartoon. Right. We can't get into that. But let's just say Mick and I were at a Writers Guild event once, and he slipped me a semi-pornographic cartoon to make me laugh. And in the middle of this meeting presentation, I started laughing so hard I had to get up and walk out. Like laughing in the middle of the thing.
You know, there's a good cover for that because I've had to do that too.
Pretend like you're coughing.
No, you hold your nose. You're like, oh god, I just snot rocket all over the place.
Yeah, that's classier. That's better. No, that's a good idea. I'd rather people think I'm rude than blowing snot all over my hands.
Yeah, right.
But Mick has a podcast called The Mick Betancourt Show, and I did tell a couple of stories on his podcast. Once about some of the worst pitches I've had. But I would say, I want to rehash them here. I want to give you the freshest beats for you guys, considering you got up at 6:30 in the morning to do this podcast.
We got up way earlier.
Farm fresh eggs.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to think. I will say this. You get to meet people in this business that are kind of legendary, that have done really interesting, cool stuff, some stuff that's iconic. And I get a phone call one day out of the blue. Want to have lunch with William Friedkin, the director, about doing To Live and Die in L.A. as a TV series. And I was like, yeah, I would love to meet.
I love lunch.
Yeah, I love lunch, and I love people that, you know, have directed iconic films. And I really am a big believer in learn from people who know more than you and surround yourself with people who have different skill sets than you and mm-hmm. people that you can learn from. And I was like, yeah, let's do this. And Gary Fleeter, who's an amazing director, was going to direct the pilot. So we had lunch, and I had watched it. And, you know, To Live and Die in L.A. is – you know, the quintessential 80s movie. And what's really cool about, oh, I don't want to give, well, it's, look, the movie's been out for,
you can
movie's been out for, spoiler alert for a movie that came out 36 years ago. The lead of the movie gets killed with like 40 minutes left in the movie. And like number 19 on the call sheet kind of finishes out the movie. Like, it's this weird, it's like, when the hell does this ever happen? But it's really fun. It's very 80s. It's Will Peterson, you know, famous, best known for CSI.
Yeah.
And the best is he's running around in like a Pittsburgh Steelers football jersey, but it's tucked into really tight stonewashed jeans. It's just so 80s, and everything's neon pink. But I watched it, and it's about, you know, this, you know, this federal agent, and he's dealing with great counterfeit money and trying to catch these guys. And
was that Robert Duvall or not Robert Duvall? Oh gosh. The main bad guy,
Shecky Green?
Defoe.
Yeah, it was Defoe. It wasn't Shecky Green.
Yeah.
No. Yes. It was Defoe. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And really cool shots of just showing the process of counterfeiting and everything.
Yeah.
And so I looked at it and I was like, okay, you know, had some ideas, and you want to try to impress someone. You know, it's Bill Friedkin, so you prepare. And I go in and I sit down at lunch, and Gary Fleeter's there, and Mr. Friedkin's there, who I have great respect for. I mean, the guy's done great stuff.
Yeah.
And I go, okay. He goes, and he's very polite. And he's like, so, you know, tell me what you're thinking. And I just start off, and I'm like, okay, so I'm thinking, you know, we have this federal agent, except we move it to like the docks of LA. He goes, no federal agents. I go, fuck. No federal agents.
They haven't even brought my salad yet.
Yeah, how I know. And I go, no, okay, no federal agents. And I go, well, he's like, no federal agents. I don't want any CIA. I don't want any FBI. I don't want any ATF. I don't want anyone, no letters of the alphabet. No federal agents. And I go, okay. I go, well, we could have like, I'm like, so my wheels are spinning. I'm like, it could be a state narcotics investigator. And he's like, no cops. I don't want a state trooper. I don't want a beat cop. I don't want a Mountie. I don't want a goddamn meter maid. And I'm sitting there, and like literally, like, they literally bring over the food, and I look at the food, and I realize I'm just gonna eat lunch and leave. Like, and so I look at him. I go, what the fuck's the show?
Yeah.
And he goes, that's what, you know, you're here to figure out. You're the writer. Figure it out. He's like, but I will not sign off on anything. And he owned like a piece of the movie. Like, there was a period of time, like, we all missed it. There's a period of time when, like, the creatives in this business had some control.
Yeah.
And there's still, look, you still have people who break out and can still get some gross points or whatever. And, like, the money is set. Look, a writer is never, you're never, there's, I remember when I got my Sopranos freelance episode, I had a cousin ask me, he's like, so what do you get for something? You get like $1 million? I'm like, are you out of your fucking mind? I'm like, are you kidding me?
They bought me lunch for a week.
Yeah, for a one-off cable script. I'm like, yeah. But there's such a misconception.
Yeah.
I'm like, now listen, look, actors and top-line directors, yes, they will make millions and millions of dollars. Yeah. The rest of it is you're working and you're getting paid and you're happy to be paid.
Yeah.
But there was a time where you could get ownership and stuff. And he had, I think, like 50% control or 51% control of the movie or something like that, or the title. I might be getting my facts wrong, but he had some control. He had control
sure.
over it. Yeah.
Well, and he's meeting you and saying, I want to make a,
yeah,
yeah.
make a TV show.
And he's like, I will not sign off on anything with that. And he wasn't being unreasonable. It was just his vision for it. But sure, I just was sure. like, I don't understand what the, I'm like, and I look at Gary.
Nothing to do with the movie at that point.
Yeah.
No living, no dying, no Los Angeles.
And no Los Angeles. Yeah. I want it to be to only die or only live in Albuquerque. What would be the name of it? No, and he was.
And that's how Breaking Bad started.
And that's how Breaking Bad started. And he was super nice, and he had a book of ancient poetry, like Greek poetry. He read me a poem. He couldn't have been nicer. But I'm sitting there looking at Gary Fleeter, and I'm like, I don't know what to do now. And Gary just kind of was like, okay. And that was, and it was tough. And
he's
yeah.
like, do you know anyone else that writes?
Yeah, he's like, he looked at you.
The waiter's like, I've got a screenplay.
Every waiter's got a screenplay. But he was like, yeah, he's like, if you know anyone that has any, that has good ideas, I'd love to have. He's like, I'd love to have lunch with them. It was really like, I felt terrible. I paid for lunch.
Oh my God.
I was invited to the lunch. That's true. I insisted on paying for lunch because I felt so bad because I felt like I didn't come with any good ideas. And, you know, Mr. Friedkin's, you know, I'm pretty sure he's pretty fucking rich. And so it wasn't at a cheap restaurant. And I was like, oh, I got that. And they're like, no, I'm like, no, Mr. Friedkin, you're a legend. Please let me. And I do respect the man greatly, but I was like, and I feel like I let him down. I was like, and I walked out and I looked at Gary. I go, I thought I was supposed to do something about cops. Or at least law enforcement. The whole movie is about law enforcement. And it just, that was, it wasn't hell in that it was an unpleasant lunch. But it was hell where I just failed miserably.
What's the takeaway from that?
Just go to a cheaper restaurant because you're going to wind up having to pay lunch. You know, pay for lunch. The cool thing is that you do get to work with people who made seminal films of your childhood, or you get to work with people that are super cool.
Yeah.
You know, when we were doing the pilot for Scorpion, I got to work.
Oh, you work on Scorpion?
Yeah, work on Scorpion. Oh. I got to work with Winston Zeddemore from Ghostbusters.
Yes.
I just got to sit down and talk with him. I'm doing film. It's going to be my directing debut, and Ivan Reitman's producing it.
What?
So it's just like I get to talk to Ivan. I had a phone call once, and he was suggesting an actor for a role, and he's like, you know, Nick, he goes, just, you know, from one professional to another, I really think this could work. And I, you know, part of it is my low self-esteem, but I just said, you know, Mr. Reitman, let's be clear. It's from one really successful professional to me. I'm like, it's not equal professionals. I go, so let's just be honest with each other. And he didn't even, like, he's so polite. He didn't even, like, laugh. Like, oh, he was just like, oh, okay.
You'll
like,
get there.
Yeah, no, he wasn't like, he was just like, yeah, he was like, he didn't, I think I may have made him feel uncomfortable.
Better luck next time.
Yeah, you get to work with people, and even some people that you didn't grow up with, but people whose work you respect so much. Yeah. You know, I got to discuss and still hopefully trying to get a movie done, although I haven't spoken in like 9 months, so I don't think it's happening. But John Krasinski, who I'm a huge fan of The Office, and
yeah,
you know, you get these incoming calls sometimes. It's like John Krasinski wants to have lunch with you, and it was really weird. You want to talk about a really weird scenario? The night before, so about a year and a few months ago, the night before, I had watched the Super Bowl at, I'm going to name drop here because I'm an asshole.
Here it comes.
It's one of my few famous friends, and I'm not like, it's funny, 'cause I don't think he'd consider me a friend, but but he invited me to his house, Jimmy Kimmel, he's good friends with someone who is my friend and a friend who I actually see as opposed to everyone else who I've mentioned. Adam Carolla. Mm-hmm. And I was doing a feature comedy with Adam Carolla that we were working on, and we would work at his house, and we would work on weekends because during the week he and I were so busy.
Is that the comedian movie that he's doing?
Oh no, that's Road Hard. That right. He did that with Kevin Hench. And by the way, if I can throw out a plug,
Go for it.
Road Hard's a damn good movie. It's out now on
my list.
It's on iTunes and Ustream, or I don't know what the hell. I'm such a techno moron, but it's on. I think it's on iTunes. It's on pay per view. It's on, like, I think direct download and all those types of things.
Yeah,
it's a good movie, and you should watch. It's like, and anyone who wants to support independent film and people who have a vision and a dream and say, I have a story I want to tell.
Yeah.
And this movie's really good, but he did that with Kevin Hench, not with me.
Okay.
Now, the project he did with me didn't happen. So, there you go.
I heard Carolla's trying to do some kind of podcast thing also.
I hope
that gets off the ground.
He might get that. He's the podfather, man. Yeah. The guy,
some pointers.
He got it all done. That's a guy who, again, his success, a guy works 7 days a week. He never stops.
Yeah.
Why shouldn't he have some success?
Yeah. Right.
But we would work on the weekends, then he'd be like, you know, and I'm a big football fan, and so was Adam. And I'd be like, Adam, we can work, but the Giant game starts at 1, so, you know, we better start early. And he'd be like, all right, why don't we work through the early games, and then we'll walk over to Jimmy's. And I'm like, I don't want to go over to Jimmy's. I'm like, I know he has this big football thing, and I, guy doesn't know me from a hall. He's like, I'll cash you in. I'll cash you in. Don't worry about it. Worst thing he ever did to Jimmy Kimmel. Jimmy Kimmel's like his best friend because I was like that stray cat that you feed that never leaves. I just started showing up at Jimmy Kimmel's house on days when Adam and I weren't working together, on days when Adam was gone for the weekend on tour doing comedy clubs, and I would just show up at Kimmel's, and I'd be like, hey, I'm here for football, because Kimmel feeds you. The guy is such an amazing cook. And oh my God. Oh my, the best food I've ever eaten in my life. In my life. And I came from a huge Italian family. We ate, well, you can tell from looking at me, we ate well. And Jimmy,
you were only 35% on the way to the heart attack.
I was only 35% since I met Kimmel. I've gone up 2.5% on the way to the heart attack. I've left Kimmel's house literally like feeling
20 pounds over.
Feeling like I need to see a doctor because I just ate so much. I think I've some of the food hasn't gotten down into my stomach. Like some of it's still like right under my breastbone because there's just not enough room. And
it's like hit a lug nut.
Yeah, it's hit something. And I just started showing up there, and like I remember one morning, Jimmy coming down from waking up. And it was 10 a.m. and God knows, you know, he's always working so hard, and he came down and I was sitting on his couch and I look at him, I'm like, hey, I brought a box of breakfast burritos. His cousin Sal from the Kimmel Show had unlocked the door. He was like in the backyard doing something because Sal was organized his football on Sunday. Mm-hmm. And Jimmy comes down and here's this guy he barely knows. I'd been coming at that point. I'd been coming for about a year or so. This is like 7-8 years now ago. But I was like a year in, and I'm like in Jimmy Kimmel's house by myself, just walked on into the open door, and I brought like a box of burritos that I got for everyone, breakfast burritos. I'm sitting there eating a burrito. I'm like, hey, how you doing, Jimmy? And he's like, got his robe. He's like, what the fuck is this guy doing here?
Which one are you again?
Jimmy's such a gracious, nice guy that he didn't fucking say anything. And he started like, I guess he felt like, well, this guy's always here. I might as well just make it official and start inviting him to shit. So he invites, and he's such a nice guy, and he invites me to his Super Bowl party every year, which I love because the food's amazing, and there's always such a nice group of people there that are really into football. Nothing's worse than watching a Super Bowl party with people who aren't into football, which is most Super Bowl parties. And this is right. Just people who are into the game. They've bet on the game. They're living and dying by the teams. Yeah. And the cool thing in LA is no one that lives in LA is from LA. So at any given Super Bowl, you're going to have people from that city that they're really, you know, bleeding the colors of that team.
Yeah. Right.
And John Krasinski, two Super Bowls ago, was at the party. And I see him there, and he's with his beautiful wife, Emily Blunt, and she was very pregnant at the time. And I'm such a huge fan of The Office, and I was like, oh, man, I'd love to go and just talk to him and just tell him I'm a huge fan of your work, but I got a lot of money on the game, and I kind of want to see what happens. Like, if no one scores in this quarter, I could win one of the boxes. Like, and so I didn't.
Are you one of the people that bets on the coin toss and stuff?
I don't bet on the coin toss, but I'll bet on a lot of ridiculous football stuff.
Okay.
And I didn't say anything to him the entire night. I just watched football, and I didn't want to bother the guy. And the next morning, I wake up, and I've got a food hangover because I've overeaten again. And I look at my email, and there's an email from my agent, and the subject line says, John Krasinski, because even my agent's emails sound like his voice. And
is this WME that we're talking about?
Yeah, WME, okay. Ari Greenberg. An amazing agent.
Yeah.
An excellent agent. And I look at the subject line, and I just start spinning because I'm like, oh my God! Why? I mean,
what
I
did
just
I saw do?
This guy. What did I say? What did I do? I must have offended this guy. But I'm going through like my Rolodex of things I may have said that night. I'm like, but I didn't even mention his name to anyone. And if I did, it would have been nothing but, oh wow, there's John Krasinski. I love him. Like I didn't have a bad. Like you can't say a bad thing about the guy.
Yeah.
But I'm freaking. I'm scared to open the email because I'm like, I'm like somehow I did something wrong. And I open the email. It's like, yeah, John Krasinski read something of yours, wants to have lunch about some project, blah, 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 blah. And I was like, oh, thank God. So I just show up at the lunch, and he's like, wants to meet with you today. So I'm like, okay. So I show up at the lunch, and I walk in. He takes one look at me, and he goes, hey, you were at the party last night. And I'm like, we could have done this last night. And it was a lunch, and it was with some of his development execs, really great people. And we talked, and we hit it off, and the project they were talking about never really was able to get off the ground or anything, but I had this movie project that I thought it would be really good for him to produce. And like I said, I don't think it's happening because I honestly haven't heard from them in 9 months. But But he and I hit it off. He's the nicest guy. I mean, certain actors like John Krasinski, like Henry Winkler, like all you hear from people are like, these are the nicest people in the world. And they get that reputation for a reason.
Right.
Because
they're
nice, decent people. But that's the cool thing about this business. So that's the non-hell story is getting to meet people that you respect.
Yeah.
And there are just also certain writers. Like there are writers who are just like, you know, I got to work with Nick Pileggi. It was the greatest year of my life. Just every day walking in and just driving him crazy with Goodfellas questions.
Yeah.
And I'd be like, hey, Mr. Pileggi? Mr. Pileggi? And I wouldn't call him Nick.
What do you want, kid?
Yeah, that's a good Nick Pileggi.
Yeah. Thank you.
Do you know what he sounds like?
No.
He kind of sounds like Alan Alda. He sounds exactly like Alan Alda.
Oh, does he?
Yeah. And I'd be like, I can't do it, Mr. Pileggi. But then Mr. Pileggi is so plugged into cool people.
Yeah.
Like he owns New York and his incredibly talented and beautiful wife, who unfortunately passed away, Nora Ephron. The two of them were like the most talented, lovely, decent couple. Like everyone in New York loved them. And I never got to meet, Miss Ephron. I wish I had, because I was such a fan of her work and you know, everyone who knew her just said she was amazing.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm sitting with Mr. Pileggi, second or third day of working with him. And I'm literally a fanboy sitting with this guy. And I go, Mr. Pileggi. And he's like, it's Nick. Call me Nick. And I was like, okay, Mr. Pileggi. did anyone ever tell you that you sound exactly like Alan Alda? And he goes, yeah, Alan Alda. And I'm like, that's the coolest answer to that question. And he's like, I'm friends with him. He's like, yeah, we sound exactly alike. And it's just crazy. And he's friends with everybody. I mean, everyone knows him. And I every day would fanboy question him, and I'd be like, "Hey, Mr." And what was cool is I refused to call. I couldn't call an 80-year-old legend by his first name.
Yeah.
So he wouldn't call me. So he called me Mr. Santora. And to this day, he'll be like, "Hey, Mr. Santora." And the greatest compliment, or one of the greatest compliments I ever got, is I was walking down the hallway one morning. And he was passing the other way, and he just like had his morning coffee or morning bagel or whatever the hell he had. And it was nothing to him. He was just walking down one way, I was walking down the other. And he was like, hey, Nick, it's like, I read your script last night. Man, you write great gangster dialogue, and kept moving. I'm like holding myself up against the wall, slowly sliding down the wall, breaking out into non-food related sweats. And I called my wife. I took my cell phone. I'm like, Janine, I'm like, you're not going to believe what the hell just happened. Nick Pileggi said I wrote good gangster dialogue. I'm like, I don't give a fuck if I ever work in this business again. And it was the truth. It was one of the best moments of my life. So you get to work with those people, and it's amazing.
Yeah.
And I'm going on and on. I'm talking too much. So you guys say something.
You have great stories.
Let's go back to horror stories.
We did have a couple thousand questions that people sent in. We probably aren't going to ask all of them.
No.
Do you have some as well?
Well, I think a lot of them have to deal with Scorpion and like what's going to happen next season. And there's stuff that you can't say.
I think there's nothing I can really say.
Okay.
Unless they want me to get fired. CBS will fire me.
Unless you don't want another season of the show.
Yeah, sorry. I mean, I apologize. First of all, anyone who watches the show, who took the time to reach out to you guys, I just want to say I appreciate you watching the show so much. I'm not allowed. They'll fire me.
A lot of these are suggestions for what some of these are things that you need to do. Apparently this person is going to get violent if it doesn't happen. So we'll just pass them on to you.
But here's the thing. In all seriousness, from another legal thing, I'm not allowed to read anything that's a possible story idea. Like a CBS will get people send in here's some fan fiction. So that they either return them or they shred them. Like I never even see them.
Well,
because if anything's even remotely similar, there can be a lawsuit. So seriously, in all seriousness, I can't see that stuff.
No, it's okay.
Yeah.
Who gets killed off? Can you just tell us that?
Everybody. There we go. I'm allowed to only say that.
All right.
I think this one's
safe.
This one's safe.
Okay.
Lynn Hodges 5 on Twitter. In the beginning of the show...
5 times better than Lynn Hodges 1.
Yes.
In the beginning, the story was... I don't know where she got her fact exactly, but she said in the beginning, the story was 70% true about Walter's life. How much of it is true now? Is it...
I don't know about that figure or anything either, but what I can say is that the show is absolutely inspired by Walter O'Brien's intelligence, his incredible intelligence. And also inspired by the incredible intelligence of like-minded people. And I say like-minded literally. Their minds are like Walter's. Mm-hmm. That's the inspiration for this show. The actual adventures and capers, for lack of a better term, that these guys get into are almost entirely fictionalized. I'd say most episodes, it's almost at 100%. Yeah. A lot of it is because, you know, look, Walter's like Batman. Like you can't get in touch with him. He'll reach out every once in a while because he'll be working for like, you know, some big company trying to fix their software or computer issues or whatever. And a lot of these big companies, they don't want anyone to know that they're having a software issue or a problem. So like Walter can't discuss that stuff and he won't. Right. So what happens is, but Walter did, like he once mentioned to me, you know, someone could be kept, just because he likes to, his brain thinks this way, someone could be kept alive underwater just by having the blood sucked out by a needle through a tube, go into a machine, it oxygenates the blood, then it goes into the other arm, and they don't have to breathe. And they could stay like that forever as long as they could withstand the urge to, you know, go and breathe in, because that's our primordial brain tells us to do that.
Yeah.
And that nugget became a central part of an episode that was... The holiday episode on our show, and it was my favorite episode of the year. So things like that, Walter doesn't realize that him just talking is going to be something that's really cool and can become a nugget that becomes something. But I'd say, you know, the cases very often have to be fabricated from whole cloth, but the inspiration and the heart of very brilliant people trying to fit into a world where not everyone else is brilliant, just people being different. And that's why I think, obviously, the majority of the world, 99.9% of the world are not geniuses.
Right.
But I think most people in the world have felt like they don't fit in at times. And that's what I think is relatable for the show. So that part is also real. You know, Walter not feeling like he fits in with other people that well is real. It's funny, the emotional stuff is probably more real than the capers.
Right. Do you see in season one, can you see a change in Walter as far as from the pilot until the end of the season?
Oh, yeah.
Season finale, like his, because the whole time, you know, you're thinking, oh, well, he doesn't have this EQ. He doesn't have emotional quotient. He doesn't feel anything.
But it's being dragged out of him.
It is.
And that's the thing is he doesn't have it, but as he gets to know this woman that he cares about and this little boy, Ralph, that he cares about, and as they're getting cases that have emotional components in them, he's feeling, I always refer to it as a little, like, acorn in his soul that was planted there by his sister, the only person that ever stirred a real emotion in him, whom he loves his sister more than anything. And that's always been interesting because that's a character that we introduced telling everyone from the beginning, this character's going to die.
Right.
And so Walter's been living with that for a long time, and that stirs that little acorn in him. And every once in a while, that acorn would move. And now that he's met Paige and met Ralph and had these cases that have an emotionality to them, that acorn's starting to sprout, and eventually he'll have a whole feeling tree growing inside of him. But it's the truth is that eventually, you know, we hope that by the time the show ends, Pinocchio will become a real boy.
Right.
And throughout the season, I think we saw him struggle with, this doesn't feel right. I don't like the fact that this is making me feel non-logically. And that's his struggle. So you see that change throughout the season, and that'll continue.
Well, those moments that he actually... he seems to be like a human, like in 12, where he's screaming out at the ocean because he can't fix the problem.
Yeah.
Those are great moments of the show.
Yeah, and so. that's fun. Thank you, and that's fun because when I wrote that moment, it's one of those things where it's a sentence or two. Walter walks towards the ocean, full of frustration, full of anger. He can't save this boy, and just screams a primordial scream into the waves, and it's a sentence.
Right.
And then it's a perfect example of what I said earlier. The actor Elias goes in and does a performance that just elevates a very easy sentence to write and elevates it off the page, and, you know, frankly makes you look better than you really are as a writer.
Yeah.
So yeah.
Well, when the actors do their job correctly, it makes everybody's job easier too.
I mean, I know it makes the editor's job easier.
Exactly. I'm like, well, there's three takes. They're all good.
Yeah, it makes your job easier. Yeah, and we have a really, really, really nice cast on the show, and they're all hardworking. I mean, they have long. And people think it's out of makeup and right. No, it's sweating in the desert in 110 degrees, wearing full military gear or whatever it is. They work hard and they work long hours, and they're hard workers.
Well, it's a wonderful show, and I like working on it. I'd like to continue to work on it if it's okay with you.
Oh, how much money you got in your wallet?
I got $1.
I don't have any money on me. I don't even have my wallet with me. Yeah, I never.
I can double your riches.
Yes.
Yeah.
Is that it? Are we done?
Yeah, we only could read about one of these.
Yeah.
Shit.
Oh, because everything else was about what's going to happen. Yeah, I feel terrible about that.
Oh, no, it's okay.
I mean, every writer on the show, like, we can give general answers, like, people want to know, I'm sure the questions are Walter and Paige going to get together? This, that, like, we can't.
Stuff like that.
I mean, we can't. And some of, I bet most of those questions, we don't have the answers to yet, too.
Sure.
You know, I don't know what the questions are, but.
Well,
I just want, the fans to know it's not me being difficult. It's me not wanting to get fired. Yeah.
Right.
I can't say that stuff.
Well, can you say that you have an idea of the whole run?
Where it's going to end at the end?
Yeah, like, not to say, not asking for it, but, like, when you're making a show like this, do you have an idea, like, this would be ideal if we can end it
I have an idea in my head of what I believe right now what I would love the ending of the show to be.
Mm-hmm.
But that could change over time. Right. You never know. I mean, hopefully the show runs for many years, and there will be factors that could change that. I do have a thought. I mean, there are things. I remember during the shooting of the pilot, I had the idea for the scene where Sylvester dances with Megan, and I told the actor, and I said to the actor, Mr. Stidham, who's a wonderful guy, and I said,
young,
just turned 22, and he's on a hit show on CBS, and he's another guy. You know, he earned it. He works hard. He's been studying acting since he was a kid.
That's awesome.
And I mean, really studying it. He wasn't like, I want to do this. It looks like fun. He takes it as seriously as any actor I've ever worked with. I mean, he has smart questions. He prepares. I just love writing for him. But I was sitting with him while we were, lighting a scene or whatever. And I said, if all things go well, there's going to be a scene where you're dancing with Walter's sister.
Megan.
Yeah, who I worked with on Prison Break, and Camille, and she's an amazing actress, and I worked with her on Breakout Kings, and there are certain actors you just keep bringing back because they're always going to do the job, and she always does the job.
Right. Yeah.
And I said, you'll be dancing with her, and her legs will be weak because of her illness, and you'll help her up, and you'll dance with her, and the song September will be playing, because I want to go, even though it's sad, I want there to be hope and an upbeat to it.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what happened. The song, the Christmas song that plays at the end of episode 12 with the little boy in the hole. Here it is, Christmas Time by the Old 97s. It's my favorite Christmas song ever. And I knew in July, before we even knew what the episode was going to be, that song is going to close out a happy montage at the end of the Christmas episode.
Yeah.
And I, you just know, you're like, that's the vision you have. So I do have a certain, and those things come to pass sometimes.
Yeah.
I do have an idea of where I want this to go. I really do want Walter to grow more and more into a real boy, like Pinocchio, but without losing all the things that make him special. I want Paige to hopefully help make, Paige and Ralph and the rest of the team hopefully help make him just better.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because if you can be that smart and be a real person, then you're unstoppable.
Right.
So.
Well, you mentioned the old 97s. We also used another song by the old 97s.
Yeah. In the during the proposal scene.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, that was a scene that I wanted to use in a different pilot I was writing.
Oh.
And, I'm a big believer in don't save your good ideas for later. If you have them, use them on the thing that use them on the thing that you know is going.
Right.
And it was a sweet proposal song, and it really worked. And the one thing I liked is about the show is that it gets a lot of nice comments I've heard from people about how good the music choices are in the show, the needle drops and everything. And
I was going to ask you about your choices of music. Like, what
I mean, I hear the choices of music that you have, and I'm like, I love the same kind of music.
Yeah.
And what would you say your music choice is?
I just want something that fits the scene, and ideally a song that isn't completely effed out. So we've got, you know, songs from the old 97s, which I think is the most underrated band in America. I mean, they're just amazing. We'll have, you know, Ray Barretto playing, you know, some really cool high-tempo Latin music when they're doing the Rubik's Cube Challenge. Mm-hmm. Howard Tate, who was one of the most incredible R&B singers of all time, who I actually knew, who I was friendly with. He passed away, unfortunately, but he had an incredible life story. I'm still trying to work on a project about his life story, and you know, throwing a song of his in there, and just trying to find music that people haven't necessarily heard before, or a mm-hmm. song that they may have heard before. We did that song at the end of episode 9, the Bosnia episode, and we played the song by Iron and Wine, mm-hmm. which was the remake of, was it a Joy Division song or a New Order song? Love Vigilantes is the song, which people might know that song, but it was this beautiful remake of it, and I just think it elevates a show when you can put in the right music.
Well, especially ending a show on such a really cool song really brings more emotion to it because you have more of a connection.
Yeah, and some shows did that really well. Rescue Me would, every third episode would end with a great montage and a great needle drop.
Yeah.
That show was so well done, they got away with it. If a show isn't as good as Rescue Me, I think after a while it could seem like, what are you doing? Yeah, but Rescue Me did it so well. We don't do it that often, but we'll drop in the
Sons
right...
Sons of Anarchy does that too.
Do they?
Yeah, they do. Yeah.
They have a lot of montage scenes at the end.
Yeah, it can work. And, you know, you find, I'll just go through my music collection and what works here. And what was really cool when doing the pilot is, I write the songs that I want into the script, like what the mm-hmm. needle drop is. And when I did the pilot, like, I wrote I'm Broke is the song that Walter is listening to when he leaves the diner and he mm-hmm. tells Paige, you should take care of your kid, or you should help your kid because he knows he's a genius. And this song I'm Broke by Black Joe Lewis and the Honeybees, which is not a well-known song, starts playing, but it put us in the mood.
Right.
Here's Walter, he's doing a crappy job at a crappy diner, he's driving in his beat-up car, he's broke, and he's miserable, and he's listening to these idiots on the radio. When I played the DJ, I was the DJ, and... you know, he's listening to idiots on the radio talking about which month has 28 days, and Walter just goes, all of them. And the woman's like, February, and they're like, we have a winner. And he's just like, idiots. And it's just like, first of all, I always talk about how that shows how low my self-esteem is, that within the first 4 minutes of my pilot, I have the lead of the show basically calling me an idiot. Like, I'm sure a shrink would have a field day with that. But the point was, is it just put Walter in that depressing state. Like, I live in a world of idiots. I have no money. I'm smarter than everybody. Why aren't I a trillionaire? And you write that into the script, and then I write this song by the 22. I put in this song by the 2220s for when Toby's being chased, because I knew it was the perfect kind mm-hmm. of upbeat tempo guitar riff. And then, you know, the director always does their first cut, and then the writer producers come in and get involved and do theirs. And I watch the first cut, and I, you know, you forget about the songs that you put in there. You write it months earlier, and Justin Lin's a guy. You know, I mean, we're talking earlier about people who have done really well in this business. Justin's done really well. Justin's one of those guys who, he can get a piece of things, and more power to him. You know, you hear Justin Lin's story. You talk about a guy who came from a hardworking family and who earned everything he has. Justin Lin he doesn't have to listen to the needle drop directions in the script. Now, granted, when I went in and did my cut, if I didn't like his choices, I could have put mine in, He put in exactly what I wrote in the script. And I said to him, like, oh, hey, you use those songs. And he just looked at me and goes, why wouldn't I? You put them in the script and they work. If they didn't work, we would have talked about it.
Right.
Like, you know, that's the sign of someone who has a healthy ego. He knows he's very good at his job, mm-hmm. but he also knows, you know what, I can listen to other people, and he's confident in himself.
Yeah.
And so that's always, you know, fun to put in the right song that works.
Does he, Will we see him on Scorpion again, or does he do pilots and films? And
oh no, yeah, he does pilots, and then I don't know if I've seen Justin since the pilot. I've spoken to him a couple of times. The nicest guy in the world, but he's so talented and he's so in demand.
Yeah.
So he's like, you know, he's doing Bourne movies and he doesn't have time for me. he's Justin Lin.
True, but I thought I'd ask.
No. You see him at Kimmel's house every once in a while.
Yeah, I see him at Kimmel's house every once in a while. No, Justin's a really nice guy. And he's another person who's earned everything he has. He just busts his ass.
Well, before we go, do you guys have any more questions for
only for our listeners? If they wanted to be a showrunner, what would you say they should start doing today? Granted that they're at
assuming they don't even speak English.
Yeah.
Well, first, I mean, I find the country of their language and try to get into that country's industry.
Mm. Okay.
So far, so good.
So far, so good. But if they let's assume that they speak English. I started at .02. You know, I mean, I was a personal injury lawyer in New York with absolutely no connections in the business. The frustrating part is every once in a while, you know, people send you scripts or write, you know, I don't even get the letters go to CBS. Then you don't get the mail, but every once in a while, even if someone I know or a friend, they'll give you a script and they'll be like, hey, you know, here's a script. Can I get a job? Can I get an episode? Can I come in? It's like, you know, I don't have that power. And I always feel bad. It's like, you can be the most powerful showrunner in the world. You're not going to tell the studio and the network, the people that are putting millions upon millions of dollars behind every episode, $100 million a season when you include, you know, advertising and promotion.
Yeah.
Hey, give this guy a crack. They're going to go, screw you. We want people that we know have been doing this job, that can do this job, blah, blah, blah. So the question is, how do you break in? And it's slowly. Mm-hmm. Very few people come in and their first thing is a huge hit and they are off to the races and they're doing their own thing. Every once in a while that happens. Every once in a while, no one knew. I mean, Billy Bob Thornton had been a struggling character actor his whole life before Sling Blade. Right. He made Sling Blade. It was amazing. And he blew up.
Right.
Doesn't happen like that for most people. Most people, it is a slow and steady one step at a time, up a million steps, staircase, and you'll go up three, back two, go up one, back four, fall off the staircase, climb back on,
right.
Staircase burns down, you got to build another staircase. And that's what it's like.
Just so keep it on the same level, I think.
Yeah, and honestly, I would just, make it a treadmill. but then, you know what, but then the treadmill would run out of power and blow up. I mean, the truth is I would say, and it sounds like such, you know, obvious advice, but unfortunately, I think it's the answer, is if you really want to do it, you have to write every day. Right. And that doesn't mean quit your job and write. I didn't quit my job. I took some time off and did it during. And then the other two scripts that I wrote while I was a full-time lawyer. I wrote my Sopranos episode while I was a full-time lawyer. And I just did it in a night and the weekend.
Well, you talk about like you're in court waiting for something and you're like, I got to go. I got this meeting. I have to.
Yeah.
I can't wait for this.
I was in court waiting for a hearing and it was taking forever. You know, it's not like in the TV shows where it's like an empty courtroom except for a few people. A real courtroom, there's 400 people in there. You're packed in there like sardines. There's 280 cases on the docket. The judge doesn't even know what the cases are about. They're like, we got a hearing on this, blah, blah, blah. And I was like, I got to get the fuck out of here. I got to go meet with David Chase. And I barely got out of there in time. And, you know, look, but the truth is you write every day. You figure out when you're going to find that time. And then once you're, and don't show anyone in the business. You can show family and friends if you want proofreading done or anything. Don't show it to family and friends for honest opinions. They're your family and friends. They're not going to give you honest opinions.
Yeah, they're going to tell you it's amazing.
They're going to tell you it's amazing. And they might truly believe it. Like if you're a parent and your kid gives it to you, you're going to be so proud of them. You'll be like, you finished the screenplay. That's fantastic. I love it. Yeah. You know, if it's your best friend, you're going to want to be supportive. I'd give it to them for proofreading. Mm-hmm. Maybe you can listen to their notes, but if their notes are all positive, I wouldn't say, think it's necessarily great.
Right.
Yeah. But write constantly, but don't show it to anyone in the business until you know it's as good as it can be. And I mean that wholeheartedly because you have one chance to make one impression. And if someone reads a script and it's good, but it's not great, they're never going to read anything from you again. Mm. Like, they, you only get one chance. So I know what it's like to so badly want to get your stuff read that when you're done with it, you're like, I'll just send it into this one writing competition. And blah, blah. It doesn't matter if you wait an extra 2 or 3 weeks, unless there's like a deadline to the competition. But then it's still, if you don't think it's ready, don't send it. Wait till next. I'd honestly say wait a year till the competition comes up again. But there's, if you have a friend of a friend of a friend who knows a manager, and maybe they can get it to the manager to read, someone in the industry, I would wait an extra 2 months. I would finish the script, proofread it 10 more times, rewrite it, then put it down for 2 months. Then come back 2 months later, read it. You'd be shocked at how much better you can make it, how many right. lines of dialogue you don't like, mm-hmm. fix it up, put it down for another month, pick it up again, change, then send it to the person. The extra 3 or 4 months you wait could be the difference between having a career or not, because the person that's reading it is reading a script that's ready as opposed to one that was sent out 4 months too early. And then I'd say sending scripts to people like me, or you know, oh, I know someone who's a line producer on a show or an editor, and maybe they can get it. It honestly doesn't work that way. You need an agent, you need a manager, and they'll get it to the right people. And the way to do that is, I honestly believe it's how I did it, writing competitions. Send your stuff in. And by the way, if you send your stuff in to 2 dozen writing competitions, and legit ones.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what are the legit ones? Because I worked in a management company, and we'd get a lot of people to like, oh, I won first place at the whatever. Just all kinds of random competitions that none of us had ever heard of. And it's like, how can you tell which ones are just trying to get money from people,
yeah.
and which ones are actually
yeah.
going to help you?
I would say, look, I bet you can do research on Google, and there's probably a million lists out there of, you know, these are the real ones. You know, Slam Dance is you know, a real one. There's a really good writing competition.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a bunch, and you send it to them, and you hope for the best. And I would say, listen, if you send it to these competitions, and even some that might be on the borderline, you know, up and coming, and there are mm-hmm. specialty ones. There are ones that are just sci-fi. Mm-hmm. And there are some that are just, you know, action-adventure or whatever. But if no one's responding, then maybe you have to take a hard look in the mirror and say, have I done my best work? Or maybe, you know, I could have done something differently and regroup and right. try something new. But I think because those competitions have managers and agents and producers are the judges,
mm-hmm.
you know, and they're the ones that can read something and go, oh, I'll represent this person. Oh, that's yeah. how it happened with me. And it was, you know, it was a very wonderful change in careers for me, because I'm now getting to do what I like to do. But you got to just write every day. And that's what I do. I write when I don't want to write. I write when I'm sick. I write when I have food hangovers, you know. I just, you know, I do, because it's my job. It's like, you know, you got to, if you're a baseball player, you got to take batting practice all the time.
Right.
I just feel it's the same. Not everything, you know. And by the way, you're gonna foul tip. You're gonna strike out. I can't tell you how many thousands of pages of dialogue I've written that I then just block delete. This is shit. Block delete. And you know, it's not all good.
Right.
You know, but you just keep trying.
Yeah, you got to keep on practicing. You got to hone that skill.
Yes.
Do you keep that stuff, that the stuff that you're like, this is crap, but it's in a drawer somewhere? Just,
I have like one or two early screenplays that I wrote after Slip and Fall. Slip and Fall was a good screenplay. You know, it won that film fest. I turned it into my first novel, which was a national bestseller and did well. Mm-hmm. And oh, can I plug my books?
Yeah.
Yes.
Plug please. Everything.
Yeah, please. Anyway.
Plug everything in this room.
It's another concept or another facet of your writing that we haven't even touched on.
Well, because it's not important.
But novels.
I've written a couple of novels, Slip and Fall, which is based on my first screenplay, and 15 Digits, which was just another book. And I wrote recently my first children's chapter book. It's for probably, you know, if you have 6 or 7 year olds, you read it to them, and up to about 13 year olds would enjoy it. It's been optioned for an animated film. It's called I Want an Alien for Christmas. You can, Amazon, Barnes and Noble, you can get the books. as a general, this is not just for me, as a general, if you want to support a writer, if there's a writer that you like, especially if it's a self-published book or something like that, I wanted Alien for Christmas, I went out of pocket and published it on my own. With my other ones, I went through major publishers, but I wanted to try it. Buy a new book. Don't buy it used. You buy the used book. Yeah. I honestly, right? You can't. I don't get a penny. And right. and I want an Alien for Christmas. Like I went out of pocket on that a lot. If you want to buy it used, go ahead. But try to support the arts. Buy a new book.
Yeah.
But you know,
we want a sequel to I Want an Alien for Christmas.
Do I have a sequel?
No, we want one. Yeah. So we're gonna be buying new copies.
So I want a Leprechaun for Hanukkah. Leprechaunica.
I'm already on board, man.
As a novelist as well, do you have to have a different kind of literary agent? Or do you have to have a literary agent?
I have the literary agency at WME represented me for my books. My last book, I Want Alien for Christmas, I did on my own. I laid out my own money. So if WME asks for 10% of it, they can fuck themselves.
Fair enough.
They have not. They have not, and they do not. But when the movie gets made, hopefully, yes, they'll put together the deal, and they'll help package it, and they'll more than earn their 10%.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Gotcha. I didn't know if it was separate in any way.
No, I don't need to. I can go outside, but they're a wonderful agency, and they work very hard for all their clients, so I've got no beef.
That's great.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Awesome.
Great.
Well, this is the your fans of this podcast gonna be so pissed because I've just talked so much.
No one's
going to finish listening to this. No one will hear this end. Like no one will hear this part of the podcast because everyone will have stopped listening.
Don't worry.
It doesn't matter. No one's listening.
No, if you were flatlining, we would have cut you off way
sooner. All right.
Did posted podcasts where just the three of us talked and we're like, no one cares about this.
Yeah, nobody listens.
So we had to bring
that. That was one that no one listened.
You did, really? You can tell how many people listen?
Yeah.
Oh,
all right.
Yeah, we don't have a ton of subscribers, but...
we got one fan.
Hopefully with this podcast, hopefully we'll get two or more.
This is not going to help you at all. At all. We can say anything right now.
Probably no one would know.
All right. How about some N-bombs? Let's just all say the N-word together.
And now this is when I leave. So I'll see you guys later.
You're not on Facebook. You're not on Twitter, Instagram.
I don't do any of that
stuff. You got here on a horse. I can't. So
if you want to send your script, we'll read it. Nick works out of...
I literally...
Your email address is...
I rode my giant... wheel bicycle here. I don't do any of that. So I did at one point when I was trying to promote books and stuff, but it just became I was spending too much time doing that and not writing. And I figure I'm entertaining a lot more people writing.
Yeah.
Full words. Full stories than 114 or 12, whatever. I don't even know how many characters it is.
140 on Twitter.
There you go. You know, there's no point. I'm not, nothing I say is that important that anyone should want to hear it anyway.
That's a good plug for Scorpion right there, I got to tell you.
Yeah, well, I'm saying not what my characters say. Okay. My characters, I think, can be interesting, but me personally, who gives a shit? I have a major beef with, like, the whole, not a major beef, but, like, the whole... showrunner, like there's like, oh, showrunners are becoming, you know, celebrities now. I'm all for writers getting respect because I think the industry doesn't respect writers enough.
Right.
But it should be about the product. I almost feel like I don't understand why people are such fans of actors. Like you be fans of the characters, be fans of the product. And then the actors are the actors and whoever they become in whatever make-believe project they're doing, be fans of the movie, be fans of the story, and enjoy it. But who cares what actor's dating what other actor or what they're naming their baby or who gives a shit? I mean, honestly, it's bananas.
Yeah.
And so I don't do any of that stuff because my job, I feel, is to try to entertain people and give people a very brief respite from a stressful world. They come home from work on a Monday night. It's the first day of the week. They've got a hard week of work ahead of them. People in this country work like crazy. We take less vacation time than any nation in the world. And they come home and just forget about your worries for a while and watch a nice show and get be entertained. That's my job. not to send out tweets or twats or whatever the fuck. Yeah.
Well, you can follow us on Twitter.
Part of the problem.
At early call time.
You can also email us and with any questions or concerns, like if you hate this podcast, at earlycalltime@gmail.com.
You can follow Jimmy Kimmel on Twitter, Nick's best friend.
Did everyone see him last night in the fight?
We were watching it, and we're like, is that Jimmy Kimmel standing?
It was
there?
Jimmy Kimmel, or one of the Beastie Boys from circa 1987. It was Ad Rock.
He's just jumping up and down, and he's coming out there with him. This is amazing.
I love that. I watched that. I loved that. I actually texted Cousin Sal from the Kimmel Show, and I literally just texted him. I go, "What the fuck? I'm watching the fight.
I'm sitting in Kimmel's living room. I'm sitting, he's not here.
He doesn't know it. He's doing that. I'm rifling through his drawers at his house.
I didn't even know that was a
Kimmel's
thing.
Kimmel's got to go over to his house.
Yeah, I got to go. When he comes back, I got to make sure I'm on the couch.
I got burritos in the kitchen. Burritos. It's cool.
Here's if anyone learned anything from this podcast, don't feed me. I'll never leave. Well, thanks, guys. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you for allowing us to have you on the show.
Yeah.
So. Yeah, this went way too long, so this was awesome.
Yeah.
It was great.
And that's a wrap. Didn't get your fill at Craft Services and you want more? Check out earlycalltime.com for more podcasts and information pertaining to the ever-growing entertainment industry. And remember to tell your friends about us via Facebook and Twitter. Thanks for listening.